Hey, what's up, guys? It's your favorite dead duo, and today's rewind is not dead.
Because today we are talking about the famous serial killer, Ted Bundy.
I'm excited for today's episode because I love talking about serial killers and what made them the people that we know today.
And there's no better place to dive into the serial killer pool than with the very famous Theodore Bundy.
Exactly. Now, with the excitement and drama that comes with serial killers, you also have the darkness, the sadness, and the gruesome details of the murders. So consider this your trigger warning. We will be talking about the murders and what happened during and after the murders, which may include descriptions of blood, sexual assault, necrophilia, etc. Now, before we get started, we just wanted to tell you all that we have a website now. Go visit us at thedeadrewindpodcast.weebly.com. That's at thedeadrewindpodcast.weebly.com. Or just follow us on Instagram at the Dead Rewind Podcast. We would love to hear from you guys on either platform. And on the Instagram, we post whenever we have an episode.
Yep. We also have a new way to interact with you guys. Once you are done listening to our episode, head over to Spotify if you are not already there and answer the question found at the bottom of the episode description. We would love to hear from you guys, and you may even get a shout out on the podcast. And with that being said, we will be right back. We are back, and let's get right into this episode.
Yes, let's get right into this case, because, I mean, there's a lot to cover. But I do want to say before we get started, we are both sincerely sorry for not uploading weekly like we have been. There's just been a lot happening. But we're hoping to get back onto it, guys. Okay. Sorry, Bob. I just need to apologize really quick because I feel really bad. Let's do this. Let's talk about Theodore Robert Bundy. That's his name. Ted Bundy.
No.
Ted Bundy was born on November 24th, 1946. He is known as an American serial killer who kidnapped, raped, and murdered numerous young women and girls during the 1970s, and possibly even earlier. We're not really sure. After more than a decade of denials, he confessed to 30 homicides committed in seven states between 1974 and 1978. His true victim total is unknown and could be much higher, though.
Bundy was regarded as handsome and charismatic, traits that he exploited to win the trust of victims in society. He would typically approach his victims in public places, feigning injury or disability, or impersonating an authority figure before knocking them unconscious and taking them to secondary locations to rape and strangle them. He sometimes revisited his victims, grooming and performing sexual acts with a decomposing... Why would you make me read this part?
You wanted to go second.
I didn't read the paragraph.
Yeah, okay, but I just need you to be serious because these are people's family members that this happened to, so I just need you to be serious.
Grooming and performing... No, I already read that. With the decomposing corpses until putrefaction. Mm-hmm. And destruction by wild animals made any further interactions impossible. He decapitated at least 12 victims and kept some of the severed heads as mementos in his apartment. On a few occasions, he broke into dwellings at night and bludgeoned his victims as they slept.
In 1975, Bundy was arrested and jailed in Utah for aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault. He then became a suspect in a progressively longer list of unsolved homicides in several states. Facing murder charges in Colorado, he engineered two dramatic escapes and committed further assaults in Florida, including three murders before his ultimate recapture in 1978. For the Florida homicides, he received three death sentences in two trials, and he was executed at Florida State Prison in Rayford on January 24th, 1989.
Biographer Anne Rule described him as a sadistic sociopath who took pleasure from another human's pain and the control he had over his victims to the point of death and even after. He once described himself as the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet. That is quoted, by the way.
It's okay.
Attorney Polly Nelson, a member of his last defense team, agreed, Ted, she wrote, was the very definition of heartless evil.
So that's just a little synopsis for you guys of Ted Bundy. But now let's really dive into Ted Bundy, because I find him to be one of the more interesting serial killers.
Oh my god, look at the unibrow in this picture. Dang. Sorry.
Okay, here we go. This is going to be a lot, and It's gonna be great. You guys ready for this fun time? This might be a long episode. I'm not really sure. Anyways, let's talk about Ted Bundy from the start. Does that sound good? Okay, here we go. Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Cowell. Cowell? Cowell? I don't know. On November 24th, 1946, to Eleanor Louise Cowell at the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers in Burlington, Vermont. Oh, we're getting really specific. His father's identity has never been confirmed, and by some accounts, his birth certificate assigns paternity to a salesman and Air Force veteran named Lloyd Marshall, although, according to others, the father is listed as unknown. And then there's some random stuff that we don't really need to know because we don't know who his father is. Go ahead, Ashton.
Oh, okay. For the first 3 years of his life, Bundy lived in the Philadelphia home of his maternal grandparents, Samuel and Eleanor Cowell, who raised him as their son to avoid the social stigma that accompanied birth outside of wedlock. Family, friends, and even young Ted were told that his grandparents were his parents and that his mother was his older sister. He eventually discovered the truth, although his recollections of the circumstances varied. He told a girlfriend that a cousin showed him a copy of his birth certificate after calling him a bastard. But he told biographers Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth. Sorry.
What?
I just find the first part of that last name very funny.
Ain?
Ains.
No. Keep going.
Where was it? Oh, but he told. Sorry, I'm going to repeat. But he told biographers Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth that he found the certificate himself. Biographer Intrigue, who knew Bundy personally, believed that he did not find out until 1969 when he located his original birth record in Vermont. Bundy expressed a lifelong resentment towards his mother for never talking to him about his real father and for leaving him to discover his true parentage for himself.
In some interviews, Bundy spoke warmly of his grandparents and told Rule that he identified with, respected, and clung to his grandfather. In 1987, however, he and the other family members told attorneys that Samuel Cowell was a tyrannical bully and a bigot who hated blacks, Italians, Catholics, and Jews, beat his wife and the family dog, and swung neighborhood cats by their tails.
Okay, the family dog? What did the dog do?
What about his wife? Like, why are we worried about the dog at first? He's beating his wife. Anyways,
And why the Jews? Can't we just leave them alone?
let's just leave everybody alone. Why can't we just be ourselves? He once threw Louise's younger sister Julia down a flight of stairs for oversleeping. This grandpa, oh my gosh, bro. No wonder Ted Bundy was messed up. He sometimes spoke aloud to unseen presences and at least once flew into a violent rage when the question of Bundy's paternity was raised. Bundy described his grandmother as a timid and obedient woman who periodically underwent electroconvulsive therapy for depression and feared to leave their house toward the end of her life. Bundy occasionally exhibited disturbing behavior at an early age. Julia recalled awakening from a nap to find herself surrounded by knives from the kitchen and the 3-year-old Ted Bundy standing by the bed smiling. These descriptions of Bundy's grandparents have been questioned in more recent investigations.
What? Bro, this man is messed up.
Yeah, well, you know, aren't they all?
In 1950, Louise changed her surname from Cowell to Nelson, and at the urging of multiple family members, left Philadelphia with Ted to live with cousins Alan and Jane Scott in Tacoma, Washington. In 1951, Louise met Johnny Culpepper Bundy, a hospital cook, and at an adult singles night at Tacoma's First Methodist Church.
Are you okay?
An adult singles night at Tacoma's First
Yeah. Duh.
Gonna go head out for this adult singles night. I'll catch you later. Sorry. They married later that year, and Johnny Bundy formally adopted Ted. Oh, it's nice of him. Johnny. What?
Oh, that's nice of him.
Johnny and Louise conceived four children of their own. And though Johnny tried to include his adopted son in camping trips and other family activities, Ted remained distant. He later complained to his girlfriend that Johnny wasn't his real father, wasn't very bright, and didn't make much money. My guy needs money.
Bundy varied his recollections of Tacoma in later years. To Michaud and Ainsworth, he described roaming his neighborhood, picking through trash barrels in search of pictures of naked women. He told Polly Nelson that he perused detective magazines, crime novels, and true crime documentaries for stories that involved sexual violence, particularly when the stories were illustrated with pictures of dead or maimed bodies. In a letter to Rule, however, he asserted that he never, ever read fact detective magazines and shuddered at the thought that anyone would. He told Michaud that he would consume large quantities of alcohol and canvass the community late at night in search of undraped windows where he could observe women undressing or whatever else could be seen. Bro, you know the song Every Breath You Take by The Police?
Dude, I'm just sitting here in utter shock.
That song was made for Ted Bundy. Too bad it was too late.
It's the unibrow. I'm telling you.
It's the unibrow.
It's the unibrow. The
Go
concept
ahead.
is. What do you think I was doing?
I'm sorry.
The concept is. Shh. Accounts of his social life also varied. Bundy told Michaud and Ainsworth that he chose to be alone as an adolescent because he was unable to understand what the heck? What the heck? Interpersonal relationships. He claimed that he had no natural sense of how to develop friendships. I didn't know what made people want to be friends, he said. I didn't know what underlay social interactions. Classmates from Woodrow Wilson High School told Rule, however, that Bundy was well known and well liked there, a medium-sized fish in a large pond.
Bundy's only significant athletic avocation was downhill skiing,
Ah, yes, as one does.
which he pursued enthusiastically, using stolen equipment and forged lift tickets.
Duh.
During high school, he was arrested at least twice on suspicion of burglary and auto theft, and when he reached age 18, the details of the incidents were expunged from his records. Expunged? Expunged?
Expunged? That's such an uncomfortable word.
I don't think that's how you pronounce it, as is customary in Washington and many other states.
Do you want to go through his university years?
No. So,
No.
let me give a quick rundown. So, Ted Bundy went to a lot of schools. He went to the University of Puget Sound from 65 to 66, and his major was in Chinese undergrad. And then he went to the University of Washington from 66 to 68, and his major was Chinese undergrad, but did not graduate. Then he went to
Buzzle.
Temple University in 68 and did not graduate. Then he
Loser.
went to the University of Washington from 1970 to 1972, and his major was a psych undergrad, which he did graduate from. And then he returned to the University of Puget Sound from 73 to 74 with a major in law, and he did not graduate.
So I literally asked you if you wanted me to go through the university years, and you said no, but you went through them anyway.
Oh, you wanted me to actually. No, I thought you were talking about like all the
Oh, the paragraphs? Yeah, we don't need to read those. That's way too much. I don't think people care that much about his education.
Well, he fell in love with a woman. Her name was Elizabeth Klepfer. That he met her in Washington in the fall of 1969. Their stormy relationship would continue well past his initial incarceration in Utah in 1976.
Sick. So is that the most important thing from his education years that we need to know?
He worked a lot with the Republican Party. He was a big, he wanted to be a
Checks
politician
out.
or a lawyer.
Ah.
So
Oh, that's interesting.
he did not graduate from law school. He broke.
Yes.
And it just talks about how he became romantically involved with another student in the late or in like the beginning, like 1967 when he was in Washington. And then, like, that was on and off for a long time. And then in 1974, he abruptly broke off all contact and stuck with his gal, Elizabeth Klepfer.
Sick.
They had a rocky relationship. But now that you know a little bit about Ted Bundy's very strange and messed up childhood and kind of about his college years, let's really get into the meat and potatoes. The meat and potatoes of my man Ted Bundy.
This the first two series of murders? Is that what I'm looking at?
Yes, the first two series of murders in Washington and Oregon. Would you like to start, or would you like me to start?
No, I'm starting, bro.
Okay. Have
That can't be
fun.
good. Nope, let me read this first.
No, you don't get to pre-read. Just read, because eventually you're going to have to talk about him being a necrophiliac, okay?
There is no consensus on when or where Bundy began killing women. He told different stories to different people and refused to divulge the specifics of his earliest crimes, even as he confessed in graphic detail to dozens of later murders in the days preceding his execution. He told Nelson that he attempted his first kidnapping in 1969 in Ocean City, New Jersey, but did not kill anyone until sometime in 1971 in Seattle. He told psychologist Art Norman that he killed two women in Atlantic City in 1969 while visiting family in Philadelphia.
He hinted but refused to elaborate to homicide detective Robert D. Capel that he committed a murder in Seattle in 1972 and another murder in 1973 that involved a hitchhiker near Tumwater. Rule and Capel both believed that he might have started killing as a teenager. His earliest documented homicides were committed in 1974 when he was 27 years old. By then, by his own admission, he had mastered the necessary skills in the era before DNA profiling, to leave minimal incriminating forensic evidence at crime scenes.
Shortly after midnight on January 4th, 1974, or around the time that he terminated his relationship with Brooks, Bundy entered the basement apartment of 18-year-old Karen Sparks, identified as Joni Lenz, Mary Adams, and Terry Caldwell by various sources. A dancer and a student, she was a dancer and a student at UW.
Which is University of Washington.
After bludgeoning Sparks senseless with a metal rod from her bed frame, he sexually assaulted her with either the same rod or a metal speculum, causing extensive internal injuries. She remained unconscious for 10 days but survived with permanent physical and mental disabilities. In the early morning hours of February 1st, Bundy broke into the basement room of Linda Ann Healy, a University of Washington undergraduate who broadcast morning radio weather reports for skiers. He beat her unconscious, dressed her in blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots, and carried her away.
During the first half of 1974, female college students disappeared at the rate of about one per month. On March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, a 19-year-old student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, which was 60 miles or 95 kilometers southwest of Seattle, left her dorm to attend a jazz concert on campus but never arrived. On April 17th, Susan Elaine Rancourt disappeared while on her way to her dorm room after an evening advisors meeting at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, which is 110 miles or 175 kilometers southeast of Seattle. Two female Central Washington students later came forward to report encounters, one on the night of Rancourt's disappearance, the other three nights earlier, with a man wearing an arm sling asking for help carrying a load of books to his brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. On May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Parks left her dorm at Oregon State University in Corvallis?
I have no idea.
Corvallis? I don't know. My small little world in Michigan does not know. 260 miles or 420 kilometers south of Seattle to have coffee with friends at the Memorial Union, but she never arrived.
Detectives from the King County and Seattle Police Departments grew increasingly concerned. There was no significant physical evidence, and the missing women had little in common apart from being young, attractive, white college students with long hair parted in the middle. On June 1st, Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappeared after leaving the Flame Tavern in Berrien near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. She was last seen in the parking lot talking to a brown-haired man with his arm in a sling.
In the early hours of June 11th, University of Washington student George Ann Hawkins vanished while walking down a brightly lit alley between her boyfriend's dorm residence and her sorority house. The next morning, three Seattle homicide detectives and a criminalist combed the entire alleyway on their hands and knees, finding nothing. Bundy later told Capel that he lured Hawkins to his car and knocked her unconscious with a crowbar. After handcuffing her, he drove her to Issaquah, a suburb 20 miles or 30 kilometers east of Seattle, where he strangled her and spent the entire night with her body. He told Capel that he returned to the University of Washington alley the next morning after, and in the very midst of a major crime scene investigation, located and gathered Hawkins' earrings and one of her shoes where he had left them in the adjoining parking lot and departed unobserved. It was a feat so brazen, wrote Capel, that it astonishes police even today. He said he revisited Hawkins' corpse on three separate occasions.
After Hawkins' disappearance was publicized, witnesses came forward to report seeing a man that night in an alley behind a nearby dormitory. He was on crutches with a leg cast and was struggling to carry a briefcase. One woman recalled that the man asked her to help him carry the case to his car, a light brown Volkswagen Beetle.
During this period, Bundy was working in Olympia as the assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, where he wrote a pamphlet for women on rape prevention. Later, he worked at the Department of Emergency Services, the DES, a state government agency involved in the search for the missing women. At DES, he met and dated Carol Ann Boone, a twice-divorced mother of two who, 6 years later, would play an important role in the final phase of his life.
Reports of the six missing women and Sparks' brutal beating appeared prominently in newspapers and on television throughout Washington and Oregon. Fear spread among the population. Hitchhiking by young women dropped sharply. Pressure mounted on law enforcement agencies, but the scarcity of physical evidence severely hampered them. Police could not provide reporters with the little information that was available for fear of compromising the investigation. Further similarities between the victims were noted. The disappearances all took place at night, usually near ongoing construction work, within a week of midterm or final exams. All of the victims were wearing slacks or blue jeans, and at most crime scenes, there were sightings of a man wearing a cast or sling and driving in a brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle.
The Pacific Northwest murders culminated on July 14th with the broad daylight abductions of two women from a crowded beach at Lake Sammamish State Park in Issaquah. Issaquah? Issaquah. Five female witnesses described an attractive young man wearing a white tennis outfit with his left arm in a sling, speaking with a light accent, perhaps Canadian or British. Introducing himself as Ted, he asked their help in unloading a sailboat from his tan or bronze-colored Volkswagen Beetle. Four of them refused, and one accompanied him as far as his car, saw that there was no sailboat, and fled. Three additional witnesses saw him approach Janice Ann Ott, 23 years old, a probation caseworker at the King County Juvenile Court, with the sailboat story, and watched her leave the beach in his company. About 4 hours later, Denise Marie Nestland, a 19-year-old woman who was studying to become a computer programmer, left a picnic to go to the restroom and never returned. Bundy told both Stephen Michaud and William Hagmeyer that Ott was still alive when he returned with Nestland, and that he forced one to watch as he murdered the other, but he later denied it in an interview with Lewis on the eve of his execution.
King County police, finally armed with a detailed description of their suspect in his car, posted flyers throughout the Seattle area. A composite sketch was printed in regional newspapers and broadcast on local television stations. Elizabeth Klopfer Ann Rule, a DES employee and a University of Washington psychology professor, all recognized the profile, the sketch, and the car and reported Bundy as a possible suspect. But detectives, who were receiving up to 200 tips per day, thought it unlikely that a clean-cut law student with no adult criminal record could be the perpetrator.
On September 6th, two grouse hunters stumbled across the skeletal remains of Ott and Nestlon near a service road in Issaquah, 2 miles or 3 kilometers east of Lake Sammamish State Park. An extra femur and several vertebrae found at the site were later identified by Bundy as those of George Ann Hawkins. Six months later, Forestry students from Green River Community College discovered the skulls and mandibles of Healy, Rancourt, Parks, and Ball on Taylor Mountain, where Bundy frequently hiked, just east of Issaquah. Manson's remains were never recovered, though. So, that is the first set of murders. Ted Bundy's just starting. This is the first set of known murders. And this is where Ted Bundy is just getting to be Ted Bundy. And now we're going to move to Idaho, Utah, and Colorado because Ted Bundy did not stay in one spot. So,
New.
Ashton, if you would take it away.
Okay. In August 1974, Bundy received a second acceptance from the University of Utah Law School and moved to Salt Lake City, leaving Klopfer in Seattle. While he called Klopfer often, he dated at least a dozen other women. As he studied the first year law curriculum a second time, he was devastated to find out that the other students had some intellectual capacity that he did not. He found the classes completely incomprehensible. It was a great disappointment to me, he said.
A new string of homicides began the following month, including two that would remain undiscovered until Bundy confessed to them shortly before his execution. On September 2nd, he raped and strangled a still unidentified hitchhiker in Idaho, then either disposed of the remains immediately in a nearby river or returned the next day to photograph and dismember the corpse. On October 2nd, he seized 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox in Holladay, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Her remains were buried near Capitol Reef National Park, some 200 miles or 320 kilometers south of Holladay, but were never found.
On October 18th, Melissa Ann Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of the police chief of Midvale, another Salt Lake City suburb, disappeared after leaving a pizza parlor. Her nude body was found in a nearby mountainous area 9 days later. Post-mortem examination indicated that she may have remained alive for up to 7 days following her disappearance. On October 31st, Laura Ann Aim, also 17, disappeared 25 miles south in Lehi after leaving a cafe just after midnight. Her naked body was found by hikers 9 miles to the northeast in American Fork Canyon on Thanksgiving Day. Both women had been beaten, raped, sodomized, and strangled with nylon stockings. Years later, Bundy described his post-mortem rituals with the corpses of Smith and Aim, including hair shampooing and application of makeup.
In the late afternoon of November 8th, Bundy approached 18-year-old telephone operator Carol Durant at Fashion Place Ma Mall in Murray, less than a mile from the Midvale restaurant where Melissa Smith was last seen. He identified himself as Officer Roseland of the Murray Police Department and told Durant that someone had attempted to break into her car. He asked her to accompany him to the station to file a complaint. When Durant pointed out to Bundy that he was driving on a road that did not lead to the police station, he immediately pulled onto the shoulder and attempted to handcuff her. During their struggle, he inadvertently fastened both handcuffs to the same wrist, and Durant was able to open the car door and escape. Later that evening, Deborah Jean Kent, a 17-year-old student at Viewmont High School in Bountiful, 20 miles or 30 kilometers north of Murray, disappeared after leaving a theater production at the school to pick up her brother. The school's drama teacher and a student told police that a stranger had asked each of them to come out to the parking lot to identify a car. Another student later saw the same man pacing in the rear of the auditorium, and the drama teacher spotted him again shortly before the end of the play. Outside the auditorium, investigators found a key that unlocked the handcuffs removed from Carol Durant's wrist.
In November, Elizabeth Klopfer called King County Police a second time after reading that young women were disappearing in towns surrounding Salt Lake City. Detective Randy Hergischmeyer of the Major Crimes Division interviewed her in detail. By then, Bundy had risen considerably on the King County hierarchy of suspicion, but the Lake Sammamish witnesses, considered most reliable by detectives, failed to identify him from a photo lineup. In December, Klopfer called the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office and repeated her suspicions. Bundy's name was added to their list of suspects, but at that time, no credible forensic evidence linked him to the Utah crimes. In January 1975, Bundy returned to Seattle after his final exams and spent a week with Klepfler, who did not tell him that she had reported him to the police on three occasions. She made plans to visit him in Salt Lake City in August.
In 1975, Bundy shifted much of his criminal activity eastward from his base in Utah to Colorado. On July 12th, a 23-year-old registered nurse named Karen Eileen Campbell disappeared while walking down a well-lit hallway between the elevator and her room at the Wildwood Inn, which is now the Wildwood Lodge, in Snowmass Village, which is 400 miles or 640 kilometers southeast of Salt Lake City. Her nude body was found a month later next to a dirt road just outside the resort. She had been killed by blows to her head from a blunt instrument that left distinctive linear grooved depressions on her skull. Her body also bore deep cuts from a sharp weapon. On March 15th, 100 miles or 160 kilometers northeast of Snowmass, Vale skier Julie Cunningham, who is 26, disappeared while walking from her apartment to a dinner date with a friend. Bundy later told Colorado investigators that he approached Cunningham on crutches and asked her to help carry his snow boots to his car, where he clubbed and handcuffed her, then assaulted and strangled her at a secondary site near Rifle, which was 90 miles west of Vail. Weeks later, he made the six-hour drive from Salt Lake City to revisit her remains.
Denise Lynn Oliverson, or Liverson, 25, disappeared near the Utah-Colorado border in Grand Junction on April 6 while riding her bicycle to her parents' house. Her bike and sandals were found under a viaduct near a railroad bridge. On May 6, Bundy lured 12-year-old Lynette Dawn Culver from Alameda Junior High School in, oh my God, Pocatello, Idaho, 160 miles north of Salt Lake City. He drowned and then sexually assaulted her in his hotel room before disposing of her body in a river, possibly the Snake, north of Pocatello.
In mid-May, three of Bundy's Washington State DES workers, including Carol Ann Boone, visited him in Salt Lake City and stayed for a week in his apartment. Bundy subsequently spent a week in Seattle with Klepfer in early June, and they discussed getting married the following Christmas. Again, Klepfer made no mention of her multiple discussions with the King County Police and Salt Lake City County Sheriff's Office. Bundy disclosed neither his ongoing relationship with Boone nor a concurrent relationship with a Utah law student in various accounts as Kim Andrews or Sharon Auer.
On June 28th, Susan Curtis vanished from the campus of Brigham Young University, or BYU, in Provo, 45 miles south of Salt Lake City. Curtis's murder became Bundy's last confession, tape-recorded moments before he entered the execution chamber. The bodies of Wilcox Kent Cunningham, Oliverson Culver, and Curtis were never recovered.
In August or September... Oh.
My bad. No, I know.
You good?
No, go ahead.
Okay. In August or September 1975, Bundy was baptized, bro. I'm sorry. Okay, it's not funny. Let me go. Bundy was baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Although he was not an active participant in services and ignored most church restrictions. You don't say. He would later be excommunicated by the LDS Church following his 1976 kidnapping conviction. You don't say. When he was asked religious preference after his arrest, Bundy answered Methodist, the religion of his childhood.
Isn't the Methodist church where they had the adult singles party?
Yes.
Of course. In Washington State, investigators were still struggling to analyze the Pacific Northwest murder spree that had ended as abruptly as it had begun. In an effort to make sense of an overwhelming mass of data, they resorted to the then innovative strategy of compiling a database. They used the King County payroll computer, a huge primitive machine by contemporary standards, but the only one available for their use after inputting the many lists they had compiled, classmates and acquaintances of each victim, Volkswagen owners named Ted, known sex offenders, and so on. They queried the computer for coincidences. Out of thousands of names, 26 turned up on four lists. One was Ted Bundy. Detectives also manually compiled a list of their 100 best suspects, and Bundy was on that list as well. He was literally at the top of the pile of suspects when word came from Utah of his arrest.
So now, before we end this segment, because this could go on forever if we don't just take a break to take a drink of water, we're going to talk about the arrest and his first trial, because there were more than one. So, would you like me to start? Yes.
Oh, I thought we were taking a break before the arresting first trial.
No, I think we should talk
Okay,
about
yeah.
this first grouping, and then we'll take a break and talk about the second grouping.
Yes,
Okay,
you can say. Cool.
cool. On August 16th, 1975, Bundy was arrested by Utah Highway Patrol officer Bob Hayward in Granger, which is another Salt Lake City suburb. Hayward observed Bundy cruising a residential area in the pre-dawn hours and fleeing at high speed after seeing the patrol car. Hayward noticed that the Volkswagen's front passenger seat had been removed and placed on the rear seats and searched the car. He found a ski mask, a second mask fashioned from pantyhose, a crowbar, handcuffs, trash bags, a coil of rope, an ice pick, and other items initially assumed to be burglary tools. Bundy explained that the ski mask was for skiing. He had found the handcuffs in a dumpster, and the rest were common household items. However, Detective Jerry Thompson remembered a similar suspect and car description from the November 1974 Durant kidnapping and Bundy's name from Klepfer's December 1974 phone call. In a search of Bundy's apartment, police found a guide to Colorado ski resorts with a check mark by the Wildwood Inn and a brochure that advertised the Viewmont High School play in Bountiful where Deborah Kent had disappeared. The police did not have sufficient evidence to detain Bundy, and he was released on his own recognizance. Bundy later said that searchers missed a hidden collection of Polaroid photographs of his victims, which he destroyed after he was released.
Oh, dude, they were so close.
There's always something in each like murder case that the police just miss, and if they wouldn't have, or if they wouldn't have missed it, we would have all been okay.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Salt Lake City police placed Bundy on 24-hour surveillance, and Thompson flew to Seattle with two other detectives to interview Klepfer. She told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches, a bag of plaster of Paris that he admitted stealing from a medical supply house, and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Oh,
Additional
sorry. That just hit me. Interesting. Okay.
objects included surgical gloves, an Oriental knife in a wooden case that he kept in his glove compartment, and a sack full of women's clothing. Bundy was perpetually in debt, and Klepfer suspected that he had stolen almost everything of significant value that he possessed. When she confronted him over a new TV and stereo, he warned her, "If you tell anyone, I'll break your fucking neck." That's another quote, by the way.
It's okay. I got it.
No, I know you got it. You can read the thing, but I'm telling the others.
Okay.
She said Bundy became very upset. Whenever she considered cutting her hair, which was long and parted in the middle, she would sometimes awaken in the middle of the night to find him under the bed covers with a flashlight, examining her body. Give me a second.
Oh my gosh.
He kept a lug wrench taped halfway up the handle in the trunk of her car, another Volkswagen Beetle, which he often borrowed for protection. The detectives confirmed that Bundy had not been with Klepfer on any of the nights during which the Pacific Northwest victims had vanished, nor on the day I and Naslund were abducted. Shortly thereafter, Klepfer was interviewed by Seattle homicide detective Kathy McChesney and learned of the existence of Stephanie Brooks and her brief engagement to Bundy around Christmas of 73.
In September, oh my gosh, in September, Bundy stole or sold his Volkswagen Beetle to a Midvale teenager. Utah police impounded it, and FBI technicians dismantled and searched it. They found hairs matching samples obtained from Karen Campbell's body, and later they also identified hair strands microscopically indistinguishable from those of Melissa Smith and Carol Durant. FBI's lab specialist Robert Neal concluded that the presence of hair strands in one car matching three different victims who had never met one another would be a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity.
Mind-boggling.
Mind-boggled.
On October 2nd, detectives put Bundy into a lineup. Durant immediately identified him as Officer Roseland, and witnesses from Bountiful recognized him as the stranger at the high school auditorium. There was insufficient evidence to link him to Deborah Kent, whose body was never found. but there was more than enough evidence to charge him with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault in the Durant case. He was freed on $15,000 bail paid by his parents and spent most of the time between indictment and trial in Seattle, living in Club Flair's house.
Did you just say indictment?
Indictment.
It's indictment.
Indictment?
Yeah,
Oh,
the
dude.
C is silent.
They can't be putting that tomfoolery on me, dude.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead. Just go. Just go.
Seattle police had insufficient evidence to charge him in the Pacific Northwest murders, but kept him under close surveillance. When Ted and I stepped out on the porch to go somewhere, Cleveland wrote, so many unmarked police cars started up that it sounded like the beginning of the Indy 500.
In November, the three principal Bundy investigators, Jerry Thompson from Utah, Robert Capel from Washington, and Michael Fisher from Colorado, met in Aspen, Colorado, and exchanged information with 30 detectives and prosecutors from five states. While officials left the meeting, later known as the Aspen Summit, convinced that Bundy was the murderer they sought, they agreed that more hard evidence would be needed before he could be charged with any of the murders.
In February of 76, Bundy stood trial for the Durant kidnapping. On the advice of his attorney, John O'Connell, Bundy waived his right to a jury due to the negative publicity surrounding the case. After a 4-day bench trial and a weekend of deliberation, Judge Stuart Hansen Jr. found him guilty of kidnapping and assault. In June, he was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in the Utah State Prison. In October, he was found hiding in bushes in the prison yard carrying an escape kit, which is road maps, airline schedules, and a social security card, and spent several weeks in solitary confinement. Later that month, Colorado authorities charged him with Karen Campbell's murder. After a period of resistance, he waived extradition proceedings and was transferred to Aspen in January of 77.
So, before we end this segment, I'm not going to read this whole thing. But he escaped. Ted Bundy escaped.
Yup.
This man's jumped from the second floor window in a courthouse to escape. So, you know where that's going to get us, guys. We've got the serial killer out on the loose again, so.
Yup.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and then we will be right back. Are back, everybody. All right, I hope y'all are strapped in because it's, and if you weren't before, you're gone. You flew out of the car, out of the Volkswagen Beetle. That was too much. I'm sorry. Now we're gonna. So Ted Bundy has escaped. I didn't want to go into too much detail because how much detail can you go into the fact that he escaped?
Well, there's a few paragraphs in that section.
Well, yes, but he stole. Okay, here, let me go. He stole a car. Somebody gave him a ride when the car broke down. From there, he caught a bus to Denver, where he boarded a morning flight to Chicago. And the jail's crew did not discover the escape until noon on December 31st, which was more than 17 hours later, and by then Bundy was already in Chicago, so they already lost it.
Sick.
So here we go. From Chicago, Bundy traveled by train to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he was present in a local tavern on January 2nd.
That checks out. Of course, he would go to Ann Arbor.
Exactly. 5 days later, he stole a car and drove south to Atlanta, where he boarded a bus and traveled, and arrived in Tallahassee, Florida, on the morning of January 8th. He stayed for one night at the Holiday Inn Hotel before he rented a room under the alias Chris Hagen at a boarding house near the Florida State University campus. Bundy later
Oh.
said that he initially resolved to find legitimate employment and refrain from further criminal activity, knowing he could probably remain free and undetected in Florida indefinitely as long as he did not attract the attention of police. But his lone job application at a construction site had to be abandoned when he was asked to produce identification. He reverted to his old habits of shoplifting and stealing money and credit cards from women's wallets left in shopping carts at local grocery stores.
Well, I mean, he tried.
Not hard enough.
He tried.
Okay, just keep going.
In the early hours of January 15th, 1978, 1 week after his arrival in Tallahassee, Bundy entered FSU's Chi Omega sorority house. Oh no. Through a rear door with a faulty locking mechanism. Beginning at about 2:45 a.m., he bludgeoned Margaret Bowman, 21, with a piece of oak firewood as she slept. Then garroted her.
Where are you?
Garroted her. Garroted?
Yeah, garroted.
Hold on, no, hold on.
No, that's right, because you, like, it's a garrot. He garroted her.
Okay, so it's garroted.
Yes.
Then garroted her with a nylon stocking. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa
Levy.
Oh
my gosh, Ashton, I'm so sorry you have to read this paragraph. I'm so sorry. Okay, I just need you to be serious, and okay? Or would you like me to read it? I'll read it. Okay. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa Levy and beat her.
I'll be right back.
Okay. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa Levy and beat her unconscious, strangled her, tore one of her nipples, bit deeply into her left. I'm going to say butt cheek. I can't not. And sexually assaulted her with a hair mist bottle. In an adjoining bedroom, he attacked Kathy Kleiner, breaking her jaw and deeply lacerating her shoulder, and Karen Chandler, who suffered a concussion, broken jaw, loss of teeth, and a crushed finger. Chandler and Kleiner survived the attack. Kleiner attributed her survival to automobile headlights illuminating the interior of their room and frightening away the attacker. Bundy escaped, but not before being seen by sorority sister Nita Neary, who came through the back door and saw Bundy as he was exiting the sorority house. Tallahassee detectives determined that the four attacks took place in a total of less than 15 minutes, within earshot of more than 30 witnesses who heard nothing. After leaving the sorority house, Bundy broke into a basement apartment 8 blocks away and attacked Florida State University student Cheryl Thomas, dislocating her shoulder and fracturing her jaw and skull in 5 places. She was left with permanent deafness and equilibrium damage that ended her dance career. On Thomas's bed, police found a semen stain and a pantyhose mask containing 2 hairs similar to Bundy's in class and characteristic.
Okay. All right.
All right. You good now?
Yeah. No, I'm not.
Okay. I just need you to be professional here.
On February 8th, Bundy drove 150 miles east to Jacksonville. He stole Florida State University van in a parking lot. He approached 14-year-old Leslie Parmenter, the daughter of Jacksonville Police Department's chief of detectives, identifying himself as Richard Burton, fire department, but retreated when Parmenter's older brother arrived and challenged him. That afternoon, he backtracked 60 miles westward to Lake City at Lake City Junior High School the following morning. 12-year-old Kimberly Diane Leach was summoned to her homeroom by a teacher to retrieve a forgotten purse. She never returned to class. 7 weeks later, after an intensive search, her partially mummified remains were found in a pig farrowing shed near Suwannee River State Park, 35 miles northwest of Lake City. She appeared to have been raped, then killed by neck lacerations with a knife.
On February 12th, with insufficient cash to pay his overdue rent and a growing suspicion that police were closing in on him, Bundy stole a car and fled Tallahassee, driving westward across the Florida Panhandle. 3 days later, at around 1 a.m., he was stopped by Pensacola police officer David Lee near the Alabama state line after a wants and warrants check showed his Volkswagen Beetle was stolen. When told he was under arrest, Bundy kicked Lee's legs out from under him and took off running. Lee fired 2 warning shots, then gave chase and tackled him. The two struggled over Lee's gun before the officer finally subdued and arrested Bundy. In the stolen vehicle were 3 sets of IDs belonging to female Florida State University students, 21 stolen credit cards, and a stolen TV set. Also found were a pair of dark-rimmed non-prescription glasses and a pair of plaid slacks, later identified as the disguise worn by Richard Burton Fire Department in Jacksonville. As Lee transported his suspect to jail, unaware that he had just arrested one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, he heard Ted Bundy say, "I wish you had killed me." So, those are the Florida murders. Now let's talk about the Florida trials and the strange marriage that happens.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Following a change of venue to Miami, Bundy stood trial for the Chi Omega homicides and assaults in June 1979. The trial was covered by 250 reporters from five continents and was the first to be televised nationally in the United States. Despite the presence of five court-appointed attorneys, Bundy again handled much of his own defense. From the beginning, he sabotaged the entire defense effort out of spite, distrust, and grandiose delusion. Grandiose?
Yeah.
Grandiose delusion. Nelson later wrote, "Ted was facing murder charges with a possible death sentence, and all that mattered to him apparently was that he be in charge."
According to Mike Minerva, a Tallahassee public defender and member of the defense team, a pretrial plea bargain was negotiated in which Bundy would plead guilty to killing Levy, Bauman, and Leach in exchange for a firm 75-year prison sentence. Prosecutors were not hold on. I'm malfunctioning. How do you pronounce this? Amenable. Prosecutors were amenable to a deal by one account because prospects of losing at trial were very good. Bundy, on the other hand, saw the plea deal not only as a means of avoiding the death penalty, but also as a tactical move. He could enter his plea, then wait a few years for evidence to disintegrate, to become lost, and for witnesses to die, move on, or retract their testimony. Once the case against him had deteriorated beyond repair, he could file a post-conviction motion to set aside the plea and secure an acquittal. At the last minute, however, Bundy refused the deal. It made him realize he was going to have to stand up in front of the whole world and say he was guilty, Minerva said. He just couldn't do it.
At trial, crucial testimony came from Chi Omega sorority members Connie Hastings, who placed Bundy in the vicinity of the Chi Omega house that evening, and Nita Neary, who saw him leaving the sorority house clutching the Oak murder weapon. Incriminating physical evidence included impressions of the bite wounds Bundy had inflicted on Lee. Sorry, I'm so sorry.
No, it's because I just can't say that word. Like, what? Adorable.
Lisa Levy's left buttock. Which, stop.
I'm sorry, I can't say buttock. I have to say butt cheek. I can't not. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have to say it again.
No,
I can't because I lost my spot.
Okay.
Incriminating physical evidence included impressions of the bite wounds Bundy had inflicted on Lisa Levy's left butt cheek, which forensic. Dude.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Which forensic odontologist Richard Savirne and Lowell Levine matched to castings of Bundy's teeth. Castings. Oh, dude. Castings of Bundy's teeth. The jury deliberated for less than 7 hours before convicting him on July 24, 1979 of the Bauman and Levy murders. Three counts of attempted first-degree murder for the assaults of Kleiner, Chandler, and Thomas, and two counts of burglary.
Mm-hmm.
I sound like I have dyslexia on this episode.
How does one sound like they have dyslexia?
I sound dyslexic. I can't say anything today, dude.
Okay, just keep going.
Trial Judge Edward Cowart imposed death sentences for the murder convictions.
Are you going to let me do my part, or are you going to just keep going?
Go ahead.
6 months later, a second trial took place in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. Bundy was found guilty once again after less than 8 hours deliberation, due principally to the testimony of an eyewitness who saw him leading Leach from the schoolyard to his stolen van. Important material evidence included clothing fibers with an unusual manufacturing error found in the van and on Leach's body, which matched fibers from the jacket Bundy was wearing when he was arrested.
During the penalty phase of the trial, Bundy took advantage of an obscure Florida law providing that a marriage declaration in court in the presence of a judge constituted a legal marriage. As he was questioning former Washington State DES co-worker Ann Boone, who had moved to Florida to be near Bundy, had testified on his behalf during both trials and was again testifying on his behalf as a character witness. He asked her to marry him. She accepted, and Bundy declared to the court that they were legally married.
Love that for them.
No.
On February 10th, 1980, Bundy was sentenced for a third time to death by electrocution. As the sentence was announced, he reportedly stood and shouted, "Tell the jury they were wrong." This third death sentence would be the one ultimately carried out nearly 9 years later.
In October 1981, Boone gave death. Boone gave birth to a daughter and named Bundy as the father. While conjugal visits were not allowed at Rayford Prison, inmates were known to pool their money in order to bribe guards to allow them intimate time alone with their female visitors.
So they had the sexy time. Like.
Yes.
Okay. All of this drama and all of this death and sadness and everything is going to come to an eventual head here, and we're going to talk about his death row, his confessions, and the ultimate execution of Ted Bundy. So,
all right.
Would you like to start, or would you like me to start?
I guess I'll start.
Go ahead.
Shortly after the conclusion of the Leach trial and the beginning of the long appeals process that followed, Bundy initiated a series of interviews with Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth, speaking mostly in third person to avoid the stigma of confession. He began for the first time to divulge details of his crimes and thought processes.
Now, before we go on, if you want to hear a lot of the stuff he talks about, I highly suggest the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix. It's a 4-part docuseries, and it's very good. And it talks about everything he confesses about on tape. So, okay, here we go. He recounted his career as a thief, confirming Klepfer's longtime suspicion that he had shoplifted virtually everything of substance that he owned. The big payoff for me, he said, was actually possessing whatever it was I had stolen. I really enjoyed having something that I wanted and got and gone out and taken. Possession proved to be an important motive for rape and murder as well. Sexual assault, he said, fulfilled his need to totally possess his victims. At first, he killed his victims as a matter of expediency to eliminate the possibility of being caught. But later, murder became part of the adventure. The ultimate possession was, in fact, the taking of the life, he said, and then the physical possession of the remains.
Bundy also confided in Special Agent William Hagmeyer of the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. Hagmeyer was struck by the deep, almost mystical satisfaction that Bundy took in murder. He said that after a while, murder is not just a crime of lust or violence, Hagmeyer related. It becomes possession. They are part of you. The victim becomes a part of you, and you two are forever one, and the grounds where you kill them or leave them become sacred to you, and you will always be drawn back to them. Bundy told Hagmeyer that he considered himself to be an amateur, an impulsive killer in his early years before moving into what he termed his prime or predator phase at about the time of Linda Healy's murder in 1974. This implied that he began killing well before 1974, although he never explicitly admitted having done so.
In July 1984, Rayford guards found two hacksaw blades hidden in Bundy's cell. A steel bar in one of the cell's windows had been sawed completely through at the top and bottom and glued back into place with a homemade soap-based adhesive. Several months later, guards found an unauthorized mirror, and Bundy was again moved to a different cell.
Shortly thereafter, he was charged with a disciplinary infraction for unauthorized correspondence with another high-profile criminal, John Hinckley Jr. In October 1984, Bundy contacted Robert Capel and offered to share his self-proclaimed expertise in serial killer psychology. In the ongoing hunt in Washington for the Green River Killer, later identified as Gary Ridgway, Capel and Green River Task Force Detective Dave Reichert interviewed Bundy, but Ridgway remained at large for a further 17 years. Keppel published a detailed documentation of the Green River interviews and later collaborated with Machado and other examination of the and another examination of the interview material.
In early 1986, an execution date, March 4th, was set on the Chi Omega convictions. The Supreme Court issued a brief stay, but the execution was quickly rescheduled. In April, shortly after the new date, July 2nd, was announced, Bundy finally confessed to Hagmeier and Nelson what they believed was the full range of the depredations, including details of what he did to some of the victims after their deaths. He told them that he revisited Taylor Mountain, Issaquah, and other secondary crime scenes, often several times, to lie with his victims and perform sexual acts with their decomposing bodies until putrefaction?
Yeah.
I don't know. Forced him to stop. In some cases, he drove for several hours each way and remained the entire night. In Utah, he applied makeup to Melissa Smith's lifeless face, and he repeatedly washed Laura Ames's hair. If you've got time, he told Hagmeier, they can be anything you want them to be. He decapitated approximately 12 of his victims with a hacksaw and kept at least one group of severed heads, probably the four later found on Taylor Mountain, which is Rand Court Park's Ball and Healy, in his apartment for a period of time before disposing of them.
Less than 15 hours before the scheduled July 2nd execution, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals remanded the Chi Omega case for review on multiple technicalities, including Bundy's mental competency to stand trial in an dude what is up with these words and an awareness instruction by the trial judge during the penalty phase requiring the jury to break a 6-6 tie between life imprisonment and the death penalty, which ultimately were never resolved. A new date, November 18th, 1986, was then set to carry out the Leach sentence. The 11th Circuit Court issued a stay on November 17th. In mid-1988, the 11th Circuit ruled against Bundy, and in December, the Supreme Court denied a motion to review the ruling. Within hours of that final denial, a firm execution date of January 24th, 1989 was announced. Bundy's journey through the appeals courts had been unusually rapid for a capital murder case. Contrary to popular belief, the courts moved Bundy as fast as they could. Even the prosecutors acknowledged that Bundy's lawyers never employed delaying tactics. Though people everywhere seized at the apparent delay in execution, the arch demon, Ted Bundy, was actually on the fast track.
With all appeal avenues exhausted and no further motivation to deny his crimes, Bundy agreed to speak frankly with investigators. He confessed to Capel that he had committed all eight of the Washington and Oregon homicides for which he was the prime suspect. He described three additional previously unknown victims in Washington and two in Oregon, whom he declined to identify, if indeed he ever knew the identities. He said he left a fifth corpse, Donna Manson's, on Taylor Mountain, but incinerated her head in Klepfer's fireplace. Of all the things I did to Klepfer, he told Capel, this is probably the one she is least likely to forgive me for. Poor Liz. He described the Issaquah crime scene where the bones of Ott, Naslund, and Hawkins were found, and it was almost like he was just there, Capel said, like he was seeing everything. He was infatuated with the idea because he spent so much time there. He is just totally consumed with murder all the time. Nelson's impressions were similar. It was the absolute misogyny of his crimes that stunned me, she wrote. His manifest rage against women. He had no compassion at all. He was totally engrossed in the details. His murders were his life's accomplishments.
Bundy confessed to detectives from Idaho, Utah, and Colorado that he committed numerous additional homicides, including several that were unknown to the police. He explained that when he was in Utah, he could bring his victims back to his apartment where he could reenact scenarios depicted on the covers of detective magazines. A new ulterior strategy quickly became apparent. He withheld many details, hoping to parlay the incomplete information into yet another stay of execution. There are other buried remains in Colorado, he admitted, but refused to elaborate. The new strategy, immediately dubbed Ted Bones for Time Scheme, served only to deepen the resolve of authorities to see Bundy's executed on to see Bundy executed on schedule, and yielded little new detailed information. In cases where he did give details, nothing was found. Colorado Detective Matt Linville interpreted this as a conflict between his desire to postpone his execution by divulging information and his need to remain in total possession, the only person who knew his victim's true resting places.
When it became clear that no further stays would be forthcoming from the courts, Bundy's supporters began lobbying for the only remaining option, executive clemency. Sorry, oh my gosh. Diana, is it? I'm sure it's Viner. I'm sure it's like a German. I'm not really sure. A young Florida. That's not Wiener, I'm sure. I need Lillian and her German abilities. A young Florida attorney in Bundy's last
purported.
Is that an R?
Yes.
Hold on, I can't do this. It is. Oh my gosh, my mic is falling. How do you say this? Purported. Thank you, Google. All right, let me try this again. Diana, insert name. I come Wiener. Florida. It's not Wiener. I need sleep. A young Florida attorney and Bundy's last purported love interest asked the families of several Colorado and Utah victims to petition Florida Governor Bob Martinez for a postponement to give Bundy time to reveal more information. All refused. The families already believed that the victims were dead and that Ted had killed them, wrote Nelson. They didn't need his confession. Martinez made it clear that he would not agree to further delays in any case. We are not going to have the system manipulated, he told reporters. For him to be negotiating for his life over the bodies of victims is despicable.
Boone had championed Bundy's innocence throughout all of his trials and felt deeply betrayed by his admissions that he was, in fact, guilty. She moved back to Washington with her daughter and refused to accept his phone call on the morning of his execution. She was hurt by his relationship with Diana, Nelson wrote, and devastated by his sudden wholesale confessions in his last days.
Hagmeier was present during Bundy's final interviews with investigators. On the eve of his execution, he talked of suicide. He did not want to give the state the satisfaction of watching him die, Hagmeier said.
Bundy was executed in the Rayford electric chair at 7:16 a.m. Eastern Time on January 24th, 1989. His last words were, "Jim and Fred, I'd like you to give my love to my family and my friends," referring to his attorney Jim Coleman and Methodist minister Fred Lawrence. Hundreds of revelers sang, danced, and set off fireworks in a pasture across from the prison as the execution was carried out, then cheered as the white hearse containing Bundy's corpse departed the prison. He was cremated in Gainesville and his ashes scattered at an undisclosed location in the Cascade Range of Washington State in accordance with his will.
And that's it, folks. That is the death of Ted Bundy. That was the summary, the story of Ted Bundy and his mischievous murders. I don't know how you would describe it. But I think we're going to take just one more quick break and then we'll come back for our last segment. But that's the ending of Ted Bundy. So we'll be right back, everybody. We're back, everybody. So let's just kind of give our, really,
sorry,
our thoughts on the Ted Bundy case and just, you know, talk about him a little bit in our point of view, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to start?
No, because I'm really confused. Just.
Oh, I just wanted your thoughts on the Ted Bundy case.
Oh, yeah. Hold on. Let me pull up the Wikipedia again. I wasn't prepared.
Bruh.
We haven't recorded this in like a week.
Yeah, I know. We're so behind, guys. We're so sorry. Life has been busy.
I'm not sorry.
Oh, God. All right.
Okay. Okay, The case, I just think the case is really interesting. It kind of just mixes in with the typical serial killer. Maybe that's because he's what started the typical serial killer.
It's true.
Like he's always got, he has a type. He.
Sounds so wrong.
I'm not wrong though, but.
No, you're not. Most serial killers have a type.
And like. And like in every serial killer I've ever seen, the police are like one clue away from getting him.
Oh, I know.
So
Well, go ahead.
I just think he's the what he's the he fits the typical serial killer motive.
He really shaped what a serial killer is because you have to remember this is still mid-70s. And so you had the end of like your Woodstock Vietnam movements with the free love, and that made people a lot easier to prey on because they were more willing to help others. And I mean, Ted Bundy wasn't a bad-looking guy. Do I think he's just this gorgeous, sexy man people today make him out to be?
I mean, he
No.
was when Zac Efron played him.
Well, yeah, but that's because it's Zac Efron. But he kind of looks like a rat to me, I'm not gonna
All right.
lie.
Unibrow is killer, though.
I'm telling you, he looks like a rat or like a ferret.
Oh, I see more ferret. I see the ferret.
Okay, you see the ferret? Okay.
He sounds like such a rich 1800s guy.
Theodore
Theodore Roosevelt.
Robert Bundy.
Unibrow is just so on.
I know the unibrow is strong, but like he really did shape what a serial killer was. I mean, before Ted Bundy, one of your more well-known like killers was Charles Manson, even though Manson didn't really kill anybody.
Did he ever kill anybody?
Yeah.
Did he?
But like the Tate LaBianca murders, he didn't really do anything to anybody, especially the Tate murders. He wasn't even there that night. But that's another episode, you guys. But Ted Bundy really started that serial killer stereotype. They have a type of person they go after. They have, I feel like you said, somehow the police are always just so close to getting them after the first murder, and yet they just can't. And not only did that happen with Ted Bundy, but he also escaped prison twice. So like, it is what it is. And he's got that, everybody loved him, and he was this guy that got along with everybody. And you do see that with some of the serial killers, like John Wayne Gacy, for example. I
Yeah.
mean, Gacy was a part of his community, just like Ted Bundy was. He was active in like the Republican Party and all of the that. So he really did shape that
Checks out.
ser I'm sorry. He really did shape that like serial killer image. And I think what allowed him to be such a crazy person was his ability to use like the end of the free love movement that was happening
Yeah.
to lure his victims. Because you had that during the late 60s and early 70s, you had the let's help everybody, let's be unified because of Vietnam that was going on and everything.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to prey on those type of people when that's what everybody was doing then.
All right.
And I mean, I just find Ted Bundy interesting because out of all the serial killers you see, he's one of the more normal ones. If you know what I mean. Like, obviously, he had to have been messed up somewhere to kill people and then be a necrophiliac and just. But you have a lot of serial killers that have that mental problem or like something is like actually wrong. Like Dahmer was somewhere on the spectrum. And not that causes people to be a serial killer. That is not at all what I am saying. But there's just something wrong. There was something off with Dahmer's brain. And in order to comprehend that, he chose the serial killer path. 99.9% of people with a mental illness are not going to choose to be a serial killer. Like,
No.
but there is something in someone's brain that kind of makes that like tick and trigger. And so you have Bundy, who's this normal guy. He went to law school, he went to college, he was a part of the Republican Party, he wanted to be a politician, he wanted to be a lawyer, was a part of his community, was married, all of that. And you know,
Right.
as I sit here and I think about it, there are a lot of similarities between him and John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah.
I mean, besides one liked women and one liked men, they really are similar though, like involved in the community, have an education, are
Right.
normal for the most part.
Bundy had an education that could have made him really successful.
No, exactly. It's just interesting, and I really would love to look into Bundy's, like, obviously he had a very strange childhood, but I, what made him kill? Like, yeah, he had an off childhood. Yes, everything that happened to him probably caused something in his mind, but what, because it wasn't even like it was an accident where, like, you look at Dahmer. And his first killing, from evidence and what he has said, he didn't mean to kill whoever he killed the first time. He meant to drug him and
Right.
have him unconscious for a long time. But he didn't mean to kill him. He actually woke up. Dahmer woke up and the guy was dead. So,
Oh.
so you have that accidental killing, but then there's something that gives them that pleasure in killing. But Bundy, there, he just walked into someone's house and was like dead.
Right. I mean, yeah.
So, like, what I really wish I could figure out what made him kill.
What sparked the killing?
Yeah, because he straight up just walked into the house and was like, you die.
Yeah, and they all, it seems like all serial killers had like something, like they always had a story that they would tell, and they would never really change the story. Like that's how they lured their victims in. Like Bundy had the cast, and
Oh
I
yeah,
can't remember what Gacy did.
Gacy was, oh, I have work at my house because he owned an electrician, like I think he was an electrician or like plumber, like HVAC kind of thing. And he was like, oh, you need a job, you can come work at my house, I'll show you around. And then he would lure them that way. Dahmer was, he targeted sex workers and prostitutes, male prostitutes. So yeah, they all have like a method to their madness. I mean, they all have a way to lure in their victim, and obviously they master it.
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, that's how they can kill so many people.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my thoughts on the Ted Bundy case and him being an absolute psychopath.
He's 42 when he died.
Yeah, he was young. He really was young.
How did he die? Oh, electrocution.
Electrocution. He was electrocuted.
Dang, they gave him the chair.
No, they were like, you fry like a piece of meat, bro. They were like, we want that Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Right? They better hope that doesn't go wrong and he just goes up in flames.
No, literally. And then they cremated him, so, like, why were we electrocuting him?
Right? Might not just burn him to death.
That's what I'm saying.
Make him suffer.
Yep. That's how I feel. Those are my thoughts on the Ted Bundy case. Would you like to add anything?
No, I feel like you kind of hit on all the points of, they just. He was very normal.
He was. It's
Like,
interesting.
he wasn't normal, but, like, he was at the same time. He wasn't. He
Yeah.
wasn't. After his first murder, he. Before his first murder, he wasn't suspected of anything.
Exactly. So I, it's just interesting to see how he had this very nor like quote unquote normal life, and then suddenly he was just this serial killer. So what in between happened? Like, I want to know what happened.
Right, because it, like I thought I saw something that like He had a clean criminal record and everything before he started killing people.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I
That's
love this
just
kind of stuff.
whack.
It is. Well, that's our thoughts on the Ted Bundy case, everybody. I hope you guys are enjoying kind of this new approach we have going on with the true
What, the
crime.
post an episode every month?
No. No, I feel so bad that we've made them wait this long. No,
That's all.
just with our approach to true crime.
Yeah, I really hope you guys enjoy it. It's something
I
we really enjoy.
do enjoy true crime. Why we didn't do this
Yes, we know.
the first few seasons, I don't know, but we hope you guys enjoy the true crime. We're gonna get back into the paranormal. We're gonna get back on making episodes. Next week we have a paranormal episode for you.
Yes,
Obviously involving the ones, the onlys. That's not good grammar. Ed and Lorraine Warren.
ones and the
The
onlys.
ones and the onlys, Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Next week. Give me
No.
next month.
It's gonna happen next week. We're gonna get back on it, you guys. We're sorry we made you wait this long, but we hope you enjoyed the Ted Bundy episode because it's
We'll
good.
see you guys on March 21st.
We'll see you guys next week. Thank you so much for listening and happy hauntings.